This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman. Hi, everybody. We're recording today's episode on January 19th, 2022, and we hope you are all healthy, safe, and well. Well, it has certainly been an exhausting and draining few days for the American Jewish community and the global Jewish community. The events that took place last Shabbat, just a few days ago, at Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville, Texas, have shaken all of us to the core. And I would add, shaken us to the core again. We now add Colleyville to the list, Pittsburgh, Muncie, Poway, and once again we find ourselves scared, angry, exhausted, fearful, and also extremely grateful and thankful. Relieved that Rabbi Charlie Sitram Walker and his congregants are alive and physically unharmed after 11 hours of captivity. A few days ago, we held a webinar with Dr. Betsy Stone where we focused on the trauma associated with such an event. You can find a recording of that online, and a couple of the clear messages from that included that educators, Jewish educators, need to take care of themselves at moments like these and process the events for themselves, and educators need to be there for their students, no matter what their students are experiencing or going through. But inevitably, the conversation even then turned, and we felt it appropriate and important to follow and move with that conversation and return to something we've discussed previously in other forum, but perhaps predictably and unfortunately, the conversation turns to one about anti-Semitism, and this time in a very violent and stark way. And while we are still learning about the perpetrator of this awful crime, it seems he was motivated by anti-Semitism and specifically anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. So to get a better sense of how to talk about anti-Semitism with our students and our families, I could think of no better person than to talk to Dr. Rachel Fish. Rachel is a celebrated academic with more than 20 years of experience in the field of Israeli history, Zionist thought, and Middle Eastern studies. Most recently, she was the founding executive director of the Foundation to Combat Anti-Semitism, and is now the co-founder of a new organization, Boundless, whose mission reads as a new think tank partnering with community leaders to revitalize Israel education and take bold collective action to combat Jew hatred. It also should be said that Rachel and I have known each other for a while, but became particularly connected through our association with the Schusterman Fellowship, and I'm grateful to them for bringing us together. Today's conversation will be one important step in this healing process for all of us. Rachel, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure to be with you, even under these circumstances.
I want to start today's conversation by focusing on the words of the FBI agent after the release of the hostages, because for me, these words are a real reminder of many of the issues that we're talking about. When he said, and I really think he said it with no real thought and perhaps unintentionally, but he uttered the words that this was not specifically related to the Jewish community. I'm wondering, like, when you heard those words, what did you think? What were you experiencing when he uttered those words?
I think that you are correct, David, to note that when the FBI agent said that, that there was a lack of awareness and a lack of sensitivity, being able to identify and clearly label this moment in time, this act of terrorism, as anti-Semitic in its intent and in its nature. I would characterize the FBI agent as a don't know. Someone who truly lacks the ability to understand the ways in which Jew hatred continues to persist in our societies in the 21st century. The challenge for me is that the damage was done. When you make those initial remarks, and we know a lot more is going to come out over the coming days and weeks in terms of the background to understanding more about the terrorist and why he did what he did. But for the FBI agent, when he makes those statements, unfortunately, that then sets the tone for many who are paying attention, who are don't knows, and also who are don't cares. And that's a real problem for us in terms of how we then think about educating a much broader audience, both Jews and non-Jews.
So I think that's exactly why I wanted to start with this question, because I think when you're categorizing parts of anti-Semitism as the don't knows or even the don't cares, we're already beginning to label it as something different to anti-Semitism that has been experienced in the past or the images that we often talk about with anti-Semitism. So there's something different going on here. And for Jewish educators, dealing with the anti-Semitism below the surface is actually pretty difficult for them to confront. So I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about how anti-Semitism in this way is changing and what it means for Jewish educators given this reality.
I think in this particular case, the terrorist was utilizing and weaponizing traditional anti-Semitic tropes for a very clear political purpose. When the terrorist asks the rabbi to call another rabbi in order to leverage political officials, that is playing off of the conspiracy theory that Jews are part of a larger cabal and influence and have the capacity as puppet masters to pull the strings and control decision makers around policy, around government. That is not a new trope. It does highlight exactly why history matters. And it's why we need our educators to understand how these anti-Semitic tropes emerged, from where they emerged, and then how they have been transformed throughout history. So that's part of this conversation. The other piece of this is that when Israel enters the conversation, which it did enter the conversation in terms of the demands that were made by the terrorist to free a political prisoner who's a terrorist, Aifa Siddiqui, who has been explicit in terms of her hatred towards Israel and Zionism, and who is deeply associated with Al-Qaeda, this becomes much more complicated for many of our educators because it is not the traditional framework of understanding Jew hatred. And that's where we need to help educators, providing greater historical content and context so that they then are more informed and have the capacity to engage in deeper, nuanced conversations with their students.
So today's conversation is not going to be a how-to or what you need to know, but let's give our listeners a one-minute history lesson here. What are the protocols of Elders of Zion, and how does that manifest itself in this particular incident?
So the protocols of the Elders of Zion, it's a text. You probably have seen the cover of the text because it usually utilizes traditional anti-Semitic tropes, images of Jews having outsized proportional influence, controlling the world, usually having some kind of negative stereotypical image as a rat, a snake. And the actual text was written in Russia, and it was written in a way in which it suggested, once again, that Jews have this ability to control all aspects of society, from the banks to the media. And because of that ability, it means that Jews are a threat. They are a threat to the societies in which they live because they will corrupt that society. And it is incumbent upon the majority in that society to target the Jews. Now, part of the challenge in this conversation with the protocols of the Elders of Zion is that the terminology and the frameworks that are created are then picked up and leveraged by all different types of ideological positions. So you will be able to see fascists, you will be able to see Nazism, you will then later be able to see other authoritarian ideological perspectives use this framework of the conspiracy theory, and it's because it has the capacity to mutate. So in this particular framework or trope of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, ultimately the Jews are envied. And because the Jews are envied, it means you won't ever be able to get rid of it. Meaning anti-Semitism is here to stay. That hatred is here to stay. And it's also because Jews are envied because of their upward mobility within those societies. And so it is different than other forms of hatred that we know exist, because other forms of hatred are about ensuring that other particular communities remain subordinate, that they remain pushed down. So the majority is not concerned about envying those people. It's that those people should always be othered. And in this case, Jews are both othered, but they're othered because they're envied and because they need to be marginalized in order to diminish the influence that they can have and the impact they can have.
So I don't need to further prove your earlier point, but I think it's worth reiterating for everyone listening today how that theme also emerged in Charlottesville, utilizing a slight variant on the slogan of Jews shall not replace us. And I think here we're double downing on noting why history is essential in order to understand contemporary events.
That's exactly right. And when we saw in Charlottesville in 2017, Jews will not replace us, that's coming from a typical right of center ideological position, where Jews are perceived as not white. They are the other. It's about xenophobia. And so that is a play, again, on an anti-Semitic trope, but it is not the trope that we saw being utilized in this specific moment in Texas.
Now, let's put myself in the position of the average middle school kid or high school kid who's just being taught about these protocols of Elders of Zion stuff or hearing about the conspiracy theories. I can imagine two possible responses. One is, how could you believe that? Like, it's a load of rubbish. It can't be true. The second is another approach which I could imagine a kid having. Well, you know, there are a lot of Jewish names when I watch the scrolling screen listing credits of a Hollywood movie, and there seem to be a lot of Jews involved in finance. So maybe there is a bit of truth to some of this. And I can imagine a Jewish kid having either of those two responses. So if an educator confronts either of those two things, what would you advise them?
Again, I think the purpose of the educator is to help those students explore how they are understanding those perspectives. And in both of those cases that you highlight, you know, you've got a student who thinks that perhaps Jews do have too much power, influence, control. And in the other, it's like, this is completely crazy. How could anyone believe this? And the reality is that an educator has to help students understand that in the American Jewish historical experience in particular, Jews have had the capacity to influence. Jews have had upward socioeconomic mobility. This is not a negative. This is a positive. This is part of the Jewish immigration story. It therefore means that Jews do have some power, and that power doesn't have to be understood as being a negative. It also means that Jews still are a vulnerable minority. And as a vulnerable minority, Jews are targeted. These things can exist together. And when we try to bifurcate them and say, no, it's only one or the other, it's actually very problematic because that is not how the real world works. So we need educators to feel comfortable recognizing that along this spectrum of these poles, that we have to be able to recognize that both can coexist, and one has to be able to say that they aren't incompatible with one another.
I'm really interested in this question because we've already heard from quite a few of our Jewish educator colleagues, this notion that I know Jews are being targeted, I know Jews are being picked on, and in this event there was a severe, well, someone said, it's a lone man attack, it's an isolated incident. Compared to what other people are suffering in America in terms of racism, xenophobia, homophobia, it's relatively small, or they're trying to diminish it somehow. We're hearing this from Jewish students as well. So I want to try and contextualize what took place in Colleyville in terms of what's happening in the broader American context. You alluded to it before. Why is anti-Semitism similar to many of these other things, and how is it different?
Sure. So first, we have to remember that the Jewish population in America is 2% of the population. We are a minority. There is no doubt about that. And yet, according to the FBI, in terms of the way in which they categorized hate crimes, Jews were the majority that were targeted. So there's a real question of why that is happening, and it leads us to the conversation of anti-Semitism. And the FBI really only focuses on those targeted acts that are perceived as religious violence, religious discrimination. So that is then, of course, going to be even more of an increase if you compound all of the ways in which Jews are targeted because of their identity as a people, or because of the way in which they identify with Zionism. And that's not even part of the conversation that the FBI is paying attention to. So that's part one. Part two, we know throughout history that when Jews are targeted, it never stays just with the Jews. That hatred, that fomenting of violence, that demonization often then leads to giving credibility and license of hatred towards other communities. And all of those other communities are the communities we know and deeply care about, whether it is people of color, whether it has to do with gender, whether it has to do with sexual orientation, whether it's about other religious groups. And what we understand as the common similarities between forms of hatred is that it is a process of suggesting with sweeping generalizations that a particular community is ultimately held responsible for the ills of society. It is a demonization and it is a dehumanization that takes place. All of these forms of hatred share that. And anti-Semitism, like other forms of hatred, also have their own unique qualities, which is what we were talking about before. Because for many of these other forms of hatred, the dominant society has been fearful in terms of wanting to say those other communities are less than, and we need to make sure they remain less than. But they're not concerned about them becoming superior. They're not envied. Jews are both pushed down to try to become subordinate, and they are envied and are perceived as being a threat to the larger society in which folks are living. So it's this duality that makes anti-Semitism more challenging for some to understand.
I notice that you're switching between the terms anti-Semitism and Jew hatred, and I want to try and understand better, at least for our educators, what the nuanced difference is between these two terms and why you would advise educators to use one, other, both of these terms in their classrooms.
The term Jew hatred was the original term that was used in Germany, Judenhass, hatred of the Jews, Jew hatred. In 1879, Wilhelm Marr, a German, recognizes that that is a very ugly term. And it doesn't feel good in a very certain sector of German society that's emerging, that's elite and intellectual. And so it needs to be sanitized. Therefore, the term that Wilhelm Marr comes up with is the term antisemitismus. Why the term antisemitismus? Jews in the European context were not white. Jews were perceived as Easterners, Orientals, and Semites. The categorization of Semite comes from the geographical and linguistic locations of what we would call the Levant, the Mediterranean. And that then was applied by Marr towards the Jews in a European framework to say they are Semites. They are not like us. They are not German. They are not Aryan. They are not European. And they never will be because their DNA is immutable. It doesn't matter if they leave their religion. They will always be different. And so we've had this term anti-Semitism within our lexicon since 1879. There are two reasons I don't love the term anti-Semitism. One, I don't love to use a term that was coined by a hater of Jews. I'd prefer not to give him that credit. My second reason is that the majority of folks have no idea what anti-Semitism is. If you ask individuals what is anti-Semitism, most likely, especially the younger you go, you're going to hear IDK. I don't know. You might hear someone say, well, what's a Semite? What we also heard was, well, I'm anti-racist, I'm anti-homophobic, I'm anti-Islamophobic, so I must be an anti-Semite. And you're thinking, no, 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 you're an anti-anti-Semite. And when we tested language around hatred of Jews or Jew hatred, it was very clear to a younger generation what we were talking about. Older generation, particularly older generation of Jews, usually don't feel as comfortable with the language of Jew hatred because they feel it is crass. And my response to that is, yes, it is, because Jew hatred is ugly. And so I actually think for younger audiences in particular, we ought to be using the language of Jew hatred.
So you've mentioned this now, so let's get to it because I think it's an important part of the discussion about the generational differences between how Jews today specifically understand anti-Semitism. For a long time, I've been using the phrase that, yes, anti-Semitism is prevalent in society, but it's not quite your boobies anti-Semitism in terms of there's something qualitatively different about it, or there's something qualitatively different about people who are old enough to know even firsthand or at least parallel to their lives the Holocaust. And now younger people today who are increasingly removed from the Holocaust, from the Shoah. And I'm wondering if you can speak a bit about like what's taking place in America today in terms of the Jewish community generationally. Are you concerned about young people's perceived laissez-faire, blasé approach to anti-Semitism? Is the older generation too preoccupied with anti-Semitism? And it's hard and difficult to say that this week. But what's taking place generationally that you can shed some light on?
I think we're seeing a major shift generationally in terms of the conversation and understanding of anti-Semitism. I think that particularly we have a generation, you know, a little bit removed now from where we are, who experienced anti-Semitism in America. There were certain universities Jews would not be accepted to. It's why Brandeis University was created in 1948. There were certain places in which Jews couldn't live. There were positions in professional institutions that Jews could not hold. There were hotels that Jews could not stay in. That is very far removed from many experiences in terms of American Jews living today. And particularly the generation a little bit older in that range of like 50 to 60, they actually didn't experience the forms of discrimination that I talked about. It was their grandparents or sometimes even their great-grandparents. So they only know of an America in which Jews have had opportunity. It has truly been the Golden Medina. And now we are at a point in time in which we see the type of anti-Semitism from the hard right, from the hard left, from within radical Islamism. And that generation of parents doesn't have the capacity, the language, the educational frameworks to know how to navigate these conversations with their children. And very often we're hearing from parents, I just want my kids to feel safe and comfortable. And of course, we all want our children to feel safe, but to feel comfortable is not actually an expectation we should assume we will be granted. It is hard to be part of the Jewish community. It is historically part of the conversation for a variety of reasons. And it's not just anti-Semitism, but anti-Semitism is a piece of it in which the external will continuously define who we are based upon their particular needs. And so I think generationally, what we are seeing is that there's a real skip in terms of understanding of anti-Semitism, and it's compounded tenfold, David, by the larger political and cultural zeitgeist. We live in a society in which you are canceled if you say the wrong word. We live in a society in which political identity is the name of the game. And usually if you're engaged in identity politics, there is a litmus test determining whether or not you can enter certain progressive spaces. We live in a world in which it is a herd mentality, and it is very challenging, particularly for younger people, to challenge that herd mentality and swim upstream. And we live in a world right now in which, unfortunately, too many of these conversations, or lack thereof in terms of conversations, actually play out on social media and not real life, which only exacerbates and amplifies all of these tensions.
One of the reasons I admire, respect you so much is because you're not just an educator, you're an ideological educator in terms of you have an actual point of view about where the Jewish people should be at, and you try to educate to that outcome. I don't know what specific language you would use, but creating a generation of proud Jews who are able to stand up against anti-Semitism seems to be a good encapsulation of at least some of what you're talking about. But you and I both know the worst thing to ever say to a kid is like, you don't fully understand yet, or when you grow up, you'll realize that you were wrong. So educators on a daily basis are confronting this dilemma, and they need tools and strategies rather than telling kids, you're just naive, you're immature. They wouldn't use that language, but they would give across that message. You're saying you don't fully get the big picture. Historically, there's a bigger context at play, but there's a subtext to what you're saying, which could also be inferred as you think you're safe. You think this is the Golden Medina, but so did the Jews of Spain. So did the Jews of Germany. I'm wondering if like that's where your historical background's also coming into play. And I think you're creating a pretty difficult challenge for Jewish educators in this regard. But I'm not saying they're not up to the challenge, but I want your advice or your input on how you're dealing with that.
So I do want to say here, I do not take the lachrymose position of Jewish history, that the only reason Jews still exist as the quote-unquote saving remnant is because of anti-Semitism. I don't think anti-Semitism alone at all in any shape or form is sustainable, sticky enough, meaningful enough, deep enough to actually allow for the revitalization of meaningful Jewish existence, period. So I'm very clear that I'm a realist. I understand that anti-Semitism exists. I do not believe that anti-Semitism will ever, ever become extinct in any shape or form. It's because it's a human trait to envy. And if you are a human, you will have that emotion at some point in time. And if you have that emotion at some point in time, and you come from a very ideological perspective that needs to blame that envy on something or someone, then the Jews will be a target. So I'm very realistic. And I also think that just talking about how much Jews are confronted with hate does not at all make someone want to join and be engaged in meaningful life with Judaism, Jewishness, Israel, anything. So I want to be clear that for me, and what I hope for many of our educators, is that we can't stick our head in the sand and pretend that hate doesn't exist toward the Jews. We also can't pretend that that hate only comes from one political or ideological position, because it doesn't. So we have to be nimble enough and understand the ways in which this disease continues to mutate, because it will continue to mutate. And we also can't pretend that it's not going to enter the conversation around identity, around politics, and around the conversation of Israel. Because if we pretend that, then we're also setting ourselves up for massive failure. And it cannot be what drives someone to care deeply about Jewishness. Judaism and Jewishness is countercultural. What's meaningful about it is what it says about our values. It's our North Star. It's our orientation to understand the healthy tension between what it means to be a Jew and what it means to be a human deeply engaged in humanity. That's an incredible, incredible project to be a part of. And it can't just be anti-Semitism that drives that conversation.
So what you're saying now directly reminds me of the quote that Dr. Deborah Lipstadt used when I was interviewing her previously. She's not the only person to have said it, but she talks about Judaism needing to be more about the joy than the oi. For someone who's dedicating much of their life at the moment to fighting the oi, I'm glad to hear you say that. I want to make a commentary on the Jewish community here, which I think I don't really want to get into now in discussion, although once I raise it, it's open for you to react to. And that is, I hear what you're saying, except I also do feel like somewhat uneasiness of aspects of the Jewish community utilizing moments like Colleyville to actually galvanize particular viewpoints to further their particular agendas vis-a-vis the Jewish agenda or their Jewish agenda, whether it's related to Israel or security or whatever it might be. For me, that's an issue worthy of discussion, but in particular, I'm talking about educators and children, and I'm worried to a certain extent about the so-called Jewish community here putting unfair, unreasonable expectations on Jewish educators, Jewish schools, camps, Hebrew schools, congregation schools, youth organizations to fight the battle of anti-Semitism, to do the work, to become the foot soldiers in this fight. And I'm wondering how you put all of that together as a response as how we should be reacting as Jewish educators given this climate that may or may not be emerging in the Jewish community at the moment.
I think it's an excellent question. Firstly, I would say that, and it's partly because of my own background and where I grew up, but much of the world, let alone much of America, is not the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side, and Los Angeles. And what I mean by that is the majority of folks don't know anything about Jews. David, they don't know what a Jew believes. They don't know what Judaism is. They don't understand any of our holidays. They don't know where Israel is on a map. And I'm not saying that to be rude. I'm saying we have this sense in some of our communities that everyone's very focused on the conversation that the internal Jewish community is focused on. And why I say this is because it gives us an opportunity at almost every possible turn you can imagine to sensitize individuals very clearly through humanization, to be able to share a little bit about who you are, why you believe what you believe, what your religion teaches you, why you care about Israel, what you think about in terms of Jewish practice. And it's humanization that is going to ultimately create that sensitivity. It's the personal story. Now, ideally, you, as someone who then engages in that humanization conversation, also have enough historical understanding so that if a person asks you questions, you can engage in a conversation. So why do I say that? I say that because I agree with you that our children, our college students, should not be perceived as the foot soldiers to solve this problem. And I think we actually do have to empower young people at a very young age to say, you know what? You are an educator. You have the ability to help create that sensitivity and influence those don't knows and sometimes even those don't cares in a very positive way, because it is through those personal relationships that people are going to call and want to know, are you okay when that kind of moment happens in Texas? Those are the calls I get from my friends from my hometown who aren't Jewish because I'm the only Jew they know. So there is something very valuable in empowering young people to feel confident in their identity and not shy away from it. And we cannot put the onus of this huge issue on the shoulders of the youth. Our Jewish communal institutions have to be able to step back and really look at all of the lanes in which there are challenges, whether it's politics, intercommunal discussions, religion, whether it's K through 12, university, whatever it may be. and really think together collaboratively. And what I say, I recognize most people don't do and don't want to do because they're more concerned about raising development dollars and not actually thinking strategically about the needs of the people, our people. And that's a huge ask. And it's one we need to push our Jewish communal leaders towards. The third thing I'm going to say is, I really think that we have to build the resiliency tanks in all Jews, young and older, and the tank of moral courage. Because you do have to be courageous to say, I'm proud of who I am, and I am proud of being different, and I want to share my differences with you. And that is not an easy position for many people to put a stake in the ground around. And I think Judaism and Jewishness and Jewish history provides an incredible opportunity to do just that.
Rachel, I want to get specific with this question, but I think it's very real. Predictably, after the events on Shabbat in Colleyville, people have already started coming up with statements and articles saying the biggest resistance we should be utilizing as a Jewish community is to all go to synagogue this week on Shabbat, in much the same way as after Pittsburgh, the Jewish community turned up in droves to do so. Let's put COVID aside and the issues associated with physically attending synagogue. On our call with Dr. Betsy Stone earlier in the week, we spoke about the real fear that young people might be experiencing, and that if we're truly going to listen to our young children, and I realize this is slightly different to the response you gave, because now I'm talking about younger children who might express a real genuine fear about entering into Jewish spaces, do we say to them, you know, the time might not be right, you might need to wait? And I'm putting all this into a conversation knowing that you sometimes refer to yourself as a scholar warrior, which gives some sort of like physical presence, I think, which is necessary. I'm also like asking this question with the background that this population of young people already refer to themselves often as the lockdown generation who are used to doing all these drills in school. And I'm further asking the question as like, what's the message that we're sending our young people when the first person that they meet when they go to Jewish school or into a congregation or into their summer camp is an armed guard? And now we're sort of like in this vicious cycle of like, we need to protect ourselves, we need to be vigilant, we need to be secure, and yet we want people to be pride and upstanding. And for a young person, that's really confusing. And I want you to explore that a bit for us.
So I'm going to give the caveat, I'm not a social worker, I'm not a psychiatrist. And so you need to turn to other folks to get those perspectives. I obviously think that depending upon the age of the child will greatly determine the type of conversation you can have developmentally appropriately with that particular child. So a lot of caveats here. It's not a one size fits all. What you say to the teenager or a college student and how you have that conversation is very different than what you'd say to a 3-year-old, 5-year-old, 9-year-old. And you all know that. I think if a child is truly terrified, you can't force a child. I'm speaking now as a mother. You don't force a child to do something when they're terrified. But I do think there has to be great empathy, a lot of active listening to understand what is at the root of that fear. Is it something they heard in passing between the parents or a teacher? Is it something they caught on the radio? What are they worried about? I think they have to be assured in some way, like the Mr. Rogers, that we have good neighbors and we're not alone, and that there are really good people out there who do not want to see anybody harmed, do not want to see Jews harmed, and would be there to support Jews and others who are in positions of being victimized. And I think that's very real, and I don't diminish that. We saw that in Colleyville. We've seen that in other places. I also do think that we have to be able to hold that fear and continue to move forward. And again, I would never force anyone. I'm not used, you know, whether it's going to shul or whatever it may be, you don't force anyone. But I think you can acknowledge that there is fear, that there is concern, that everything in terms of engaging in Jewish life is a risk. I don't think we can pretend it is not. And I think we have to ensure to the best of our organizational abilities that that risk is mitigated, knowing full well it can never be completely 100% ensured. And our job is to help our young people take those baby steps forward. And also to help them understand that we live in community. Jewish life is about community, and we cannot do this, meaning Jewish work, in isolation or alone. And so it's going to be a healthy dance, I think, depending upon world events and people's emotions, of 2 steps forward, 1 step back. And we have to be able to be patient and compassionate throughout that entire process.
I think in so many ways, you've also just given us and the audience a great definition of terrorism, that there was the physical acts which took place in Colleyville, but in essence, terrorism is designed to inflict not only the pain of the moment, but a real terror or a fear well beyond that moment itself, and has us all checking exits when we walk into Jewish spaces, or to being extra vigilant. You know, as my daughter on the way to school the other day did, she counted the number of guards in the school. And I think this is, as you said before, it might be something we just have to get used to living with. But there was something else you said, which I think is also interesting, is that we have to remind ourselves there are more good people in the world than these people who are out to get us or out to inflict harm or pain on others. And I've had a question from a few educators already, Jewish educators, about what's our responsibility to the Muslim community in all of this. And it's an interesting question to ask in terms of why on earth would anybody expect the victims to actually have any responsibility? But here you have a situation where the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of the Muslim community in America is outraged by this. They might not have the same mechanism to express it communally that we might be accustomed to as a Jewish community. But I'm really fearful that this is going to lead to more racial profiling. This is going to lead to more mistrust of our young Jews against the Muslim population. How do you talk about our interaction with Islam and with Muslims in the context of what took place in Colleyville?
I do think it's important that Jews always, always avoid the generalizations and stereotypes in order to perpetrate any kind of discrimination or harm towards any particular people. I also do not think we can ignore that the perpetrator, the terrorist, was a man of color and was Muslim. And I don't think we can shy away from that, and I don't think we should shy away from that. We wouldn't shy away from it at all if it was another type of profile for a terrorist targeting the Jews. And I think when we do shy away from it, David, and I know what I'm saying is not comfortable, especially for many educators, but I think when we do shy away from it, we're actually engaged in a form of soft racism. And we can't do that. And we have to be able to denounce hatred, however it manifests. And of course, we have to do exactly as you said, which is highlight the voices coming from within the Muslim world who are clearly denouncing what has happened, who are building bridges between communities, just like they had been before this and will continue to do so after this. And the greater bridge building activities you can have between communities, it goes back to what I said earlier, the greater chance you have of humanizing and understanding and building that muscle of compassion and empathy. But I get nervous when I hear, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but when I hear from within certain sectors of the Jewish community that they're reluctant to actually name this for what it is. And they're reluctant because of the identity of the perpetrator, the identity of the terrorist. And I think that is a trap we cannot fall into.
So I want to just offer one piece of possible practical instruction or advice to Jewish educators. We're doing this event as a reaction to what happened in Colleyville, but I want to offer a proactive measure. If you are a Jewish educator and you have the capacity to start doing some proactive dialogue, discussion with Muslim neighbors or Muslim colleagues, like, now is the time to seize upon this opportunity to do so, because we need to be more proactive in these discussions and we can't always be reactive. Otherwise, we're left with exactly the conundrum that you're talking about. If proactively you have relations with all of your neighbors, that becomes a much simpler, easier conversation to have with your kids on almost every issue. But in this one specifically, if you've taken the proactive measures, what you said makes a lot of sense. I think in the context of doing it reactively without any prior relationship, that what you're saying gets educators caught in a whole spiral of difficulty. I think one of the questions I also want to ask you, and we've spoken about this before in the context of Israel and the Israel-Palestine conflict, is the role of social media in educating our children. And this week's events in Colleyville had almost the bizarre subplot of at least the first hour of an 11-hour ordeal being live streamed on Facebook. That is so difficult to comprehend what that was like for people viewing it. And now, obviously, the social media has a life of its own when talking about the events of Colleyville. I'm wondering if you can just offer educators some advice on how to talk to young people about social media in circumstances like this? Is it something you would say avoid at all costs? Is it something that you would say filter at your discretion? Like, how would you advise educators to talk to their younger youth about the use of social media at moments like this?
I mean, this is where it's very interesting because, for example, we were getting more information faster on Twitter, once again, than we were from credible news sources. And that's for a variety of reasons. And so there's a place where, again, social can be very valuable if you can verify the data that's coming in and put it within a larger context and make sure that it has veracity. The challenge here is the conversations, or lack thereof, again, of a real conversation when there's not a real relationship with the individual, and that plays out in emotional social media posts. I'm very realistic. I personally hate social media, but I'm realistic to understand that the majority of young people and the majority of our world see social media as an extension of their real life. That's a whole separate conversation, one that deserves explication. But for this particular conversation around anti-Semitism, I think that if you are in relation, right, meaningful engagement with someone, you know them, and they're posting things that are challenging or problematic, the goal is to eventually get that person in a real conversation in real life and not through social. If it's someone you know and you know they have influence among your peer group and they are reaching a lot of those don't knows, don't cares, all the more so that's a reason. You want them to understand your position and how it impacts you. And that's, again, that humanization process. I think for those who see things on social from quote unquote influencers, it's all performative allyship for the most part. You are not going to change any hearts or minds by engaging with any of that performative allyship. And it is a waste of time. And only what we have seen leads to really difficult issues and a real sense of that burden that you were talking about earlier, David, in terms of, oh, the onus is on me. And nobody is going to win in that conversation that's taking place on social. So you do more harm than good. And the majority of young people don't know how to recognize if it's a post that's being put out by a foreign influence. And yes, that's a real thing. And they don't understand how the algorithms work and the trolls and the bots that feed that algorithm. And so you're actually just engaging in something that is highly problematic and not good for your mental health.
Wow. Rachel, final words from you. What's one piece of advice, encouragement, chizuk, strength that you would offer to Jewish educators today in the aftermath of Colleyville?
First, I want to say to the Jewish educators, David, that they are doing such meaningful work. There are very few people who have the capacity to touch children the way these educators have in terms of their identity formation and the impact they can have on their identity formation. And they are a trusted adult seen by these children and teens. And that is a gift that they are providing and a service they are providing to the community. And so I want to recognize that, and all the more so given the era of COVID. I also do think it's an incredible responsibility. And what I mean by that is you may be the most important influence Jewishly on that individual. And I'm not trying to overburden the Jewish educators now, but it is a real responsibility. And so you as educators have to have the content, the context of these matters historically and how they play out today in order to have the confidence to engage in an authentic and meaningful way with any student that comes to you. And if you find yourself shying away from these topics, I think it's really important to ask yourself and reflect on, why am I shying away? Is it a gap in my knowledge? Is it about my inability to facilitate? Is it that I'm concerned about the political minefield? And really try to think through, where are the challenges? And then find the resources through you, David, the Jewish Education Project, the network of educators, me, who can help specifically address those particular gaps in comfort and confidence in order to be the best educator they could possibly be.
Rachel, thank you so much for today's episode. Thank you to everybody listening to today's episode. This is a powerful reminder of the issue behind the issue, so to speak. And I think we should all be cognizant of that. The Jewish Education Project, as Rachel mentioned, has plenty of resources, and we'll have links to those resources in the show notes, which we hope and think can be useful for Jewish educators. I do want to just take a moment to really say, though, that one of the messages we are trying to put out to all of our Jewish educators out there is that you will only be the best version of yourself as an educator if you have had the moment, the time to reflect, to process, to come to terms with what happened in Colleyville for yourself as well. This also requires you to take a bit of time off for yourself to look after your own physical and mental well-being. I encourage you, if you haven't already done so, close your eyes, refresh yourselves, go for a walk. But really, Rachel, thank you for really opening up our eyes to so much about the backdrop of what was taking place in Colleyville. And thank you for being a trusted friend and colleague of myself and of the Jewish Education Project.
Thank you so much, David.
Today's episode was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Gabriel Weinstein. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media, who, in an ironic twist of connections and relationships in the Jewish community, is a former student of Rachel Fish at Brandeis University. If you enjoyed today's episode of Adapting, please make sure to give it a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, and please share it with some of your friends. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, please visit us at jewishedproject.org, where you can learn more about the organization, its mission, history, and staff. And as always, we are proud to be in partnership with UJA Federation of New York. Thank you to Rachel, and thank you to everyone for listening to today's episode.